It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The comedian Roy Wood Jr. hosted this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner. He delivered a speech that was half comedy roast and half social commentary. Speaking to a room full of reporters and editors from some of the biggest publications across the country, he pointed out one of the biggest problems he sees in the media industry today.
All the essential, fair, and nuanced reporting, it's all stuck behind a paywall. People can't afford rent. People can't afford food, not healthy food. They can't afford an education. They damn sure can't afford to pay for the truth. Say what you want about a conspiracy theory, but at least it's affordable. I mean, well, unless you Alex Jones, it'll cost you about $900 million. And I understand that we have to put the stuff behind the paywall because creating the truth is important. People can't afford the truth, but you all can't afford to go find the truth for free.
Wood's speech highlighted a challenge journalists face when it comes to funding their work. Quality reporting can be expensive, it takes a lot of time, and online ad revenue alone generally isn't enough to pay for it. Paywall subscriptions can generate the kind of revenue needed to pay for in-depth journalism. That can create, though, an information gap between those who can afford to pay for quality reporting and those who can't. It's a problem that outlets around the country are struggling to work through. Some are experimenting with new and creative ways to fund their work while keeping their reporting as accessible as possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get frustrated when you run into online paywalls for that article, that one article that you want to read? Do you subscribe to some publications, local, regional, national, that have these kind of paywalls? Do you feel like you miss out on quality journalism because you can't afford to subscribe to these services? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. This summer, she'll take over as the new director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be here.
How big a problem do you see this being, that there may be an information gap between people who can afford to subscribe to news services and those who can't?
I think that there's always been a problem with that, with having balanced and reliable information. People subscribed to the newspaper in the 1950s and 60s, and people who could afford it did, and people who couldn't afford it didn't. So the gap isn't necessarily something that's new. What's new is the malignancy of conspiracy theories, misinformation, disinformation that is free. So this is now available to us online when it wasn't in the 1950s or 60s when my parents were subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal.
Are there things about the economics of the news media now that makes it more of a reach for people, especially to get local reporting that's valuable to them, given the economics of the situation?
Yeah, the economics for local news are not pretty. And it relates in part to a loss of subscribers, but also, importantly, a loss of advertisers. So if you look about 10 to 12 years ago, we were at about 12% of the national ad spend. So everyone from your local car dealer to Dove soap was going toward local news. Now that number is about 2%. So you see advertising going to other places, including targeted social media advertising.
Now, the information gap we started with was between those who could afford a subscription and those who couldn't. How about between places that are maybe bigger cities that are packed with media outlets and smaller towns, rural communities? Is that so-called news deserts? Is that an information gap you worry about?
It's absolutely an information gap that I worry about. News deserts are very, very serious in places like Wisconsin and, in fact, all over the country. But one of the things that some research is showing is that those news deserts have increasing polarization, because they don't have the local news outlet. They're sort of nationalized in their politics. So rather than thinking about who's the neighbor I want to run for the local school board, they're more heavily fixated on, say, a Senate race in Georgia, because their news sources are more nationalized.
Let's look at different possible funding models for, you know, the online age of news. Now, for a while, there was the idea that we're going to do it all with web advertising, online advertising, which means we're going to have so many stories that go so viral and we'll get so many clicks. And how's that worked out?
It hasn't worked out. We have not solved the advertising conundrum for news in any way. And so we do have to look at other funding models. Part of that's going to be philanthropy. Part of it is going to be looking at things like nonprofit approaches, and then also public media, like we're on right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about paywalls? articles. It seems like news outlets, some of the big national newspapers, have enough of a subscriber base, enough of a reach that that is a viable model.
It is, especially depending on your audience. The Wall Street Journal probably has the most viable paywall, given that a lot of businesses pay for its subscriptions for their employees. I think you are seeing some real thoughtfulness and some ethics and integrity coming into paywall discussions now, particularly when we went through COVID and people needing all of that information. Most outlets put that information outside of the, in front of their paywall so that you didn't have to pay to get it. And so now I hear from some editors and publishers who are saying, you know, hey, maybe it makes sense to have the latest Green Bay Packers Aaron Rodgers trade behind the paywall, but I'm going to put this election information out in front of it because, sadly, some people are more likely to pay for Packer info than they are to figure out who to vote for.
I know this isn't a brand new concern with the internet, but is there a worry that, okay, if I know a certain group of people can afford to pay for my web service, for my newspaper, I'm going to craft my news to appeal to that kind of customer?
Sure, to appeal to that kind of customer, and then also to appeal to what's the most clickable. Are we getting more sensationalism? Are we getting less substantive coverage? Those are all really important worries.
Do you think we are getting more of that? Because I know I've talked on the show about, you know, the 1800s, a newspaper publisher who had a great series on the discoveries of life on Mars with surprising detail. Like, sensationalism isn't new. Do you think it is in some ways worse now?
Sensationalism is not new, but it has more reach than it used to have. In some ways, less reach because we do have fewer super powerhouse, everybody, you know, watches Walter Cronkite kind of figures. There's more atomization, so there's more choice. But those things that are bogus are getting better reach now.
Talking to Kathleen Culver from the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison, looking at access to news, affordability of news services in the modern media age. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you subscribe to a physical newspaper? Do you pay to see the stories behind paywalls on your local newspaper, a big city newspaper, one of the national outlets? Does it keep you away, a paywall, from seeing stories you want to see? Call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Allison in Madison couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know about the importance of libraries in accessing news and whether that's changed with online paywalls. Now, a lot of libraries do have subscriptions to periodicals and daily papers.
I love Allison's question because I could not possibly be a bigger fan of the public library. You know, when we talk about news deserts, one of the things that we think about is what other civic institutions are important in bringing us together, in getting us to talk about the local soccer team, to pay attention to the new business opening. And I think that libraries are one of those critical civic institutions. And they are places that we can access information, reliable information, for free.
Thanks a lot for that question, Allison. You also mentioned, Katie, outlets saying, okay, maybe that Packers news, you got to pay for that, but the election news, we'll let you have at least some of that for free. I know during COVID, some paywall outlets put the daily COVID tracker information in front of the paywall, not behind it, so people get it. What other kind of distinctions could we make between, okay, this is our public service and you can have it for free versus this is stuff you got to pay for?
You know, it's such an important and vital question. And I bump into it sometimes with people who contact me because someone has tried to share something with them and they used to be able to access it if it was shared via social media. But a lot of outlets have now changed that practice as well. So I think vital civic information, there's an argument for that to be in front of the paywall. But then also each of us as citizens asking, what investment are we making in news? And that you may not enjoy your local news outlet and it may be too expensive and you don't want to place your investment there. Are you maybe making a donation to public media? Are you looking at other ways to support news? Because it's not just on the news media to fix this problem. All of us who need that information have to be invested too.
We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Katie Culver about online paywalls and the costs of quality journalism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're in a news desert in some ways where, especially maybe for local news, local government news, you don't get a lot of reporting on it, maybe not as much as you used to? And at whatever level do you subscribe to a newspaper, whether in print or online? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Katie Culver, professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're talking about journalism behind paywalls and the conflict between access to quality reporting and how to pay for it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What kind of reporting are you willing to pay for? Is there something that you subscribe to? Love to hear what it is. Would you be willing to pay more for a particular kind of journalism, a particular coverage maybe in your local area? What questions do you have about how journalism is funded or not funded in some cases? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@WPR.org. Katie, you mentioned briefly earlier there are nonprofit models, not just public media, public radio, and public TV. What kind of things do you see out there that look promising?
I think the Salt Lake Tribune is one of the more promising nonprofits, startups. It's a longstanding legacy paper, mm-hmm. But they went to that model a few years ago, and they are making it work. Right here in Wisconsin, there's the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism at wisconsinwatch.org. They do phenomenal work. There are a number of those peppered across the country. But they're not easy. This is not easy to make these go.
Yeah. Have we seen some come and go? Are there failed models of nonprofit attempts at journalism?
Sure. Plenty of them. Plenty of them. And I think we have the opportunity to learn from those. But we also need to be sure that there's an audience to support that nonprofit approach. There are some that are tremendously successful, in fact, winning Pulitzer Prizes and the like. I'm hopeful in part, but we need to invest in it.
Something I wonder about, something I worry about is, you know, every community has county board meetings and city council meetings and school board meetings. They can be a little dry to sit through in person. I've been there. But that kind of coverage can be really important. And it might be the most important for some people. It's what's happening in their backyard. Do you see models that work in communities that may not have a huge, you know, population to begin with?
I do think there's the possibility for citizens to get involved. We're seeing more of that activity going and looking at school boards, for instance. But you're right. When there is not systematic local coverage, there are all sorts of shenanigans and malfeasance that could go on. There's the tiny community of Bell, California, lost its regional newspaper reporter, and within a short span of time, some very powerful people there had bilked their citizens out of millions of dollars because there was no journalist watching.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barry is with us in Green Bay. Barry, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Barry?
Yes, I'm interested in your conversation. I equate having a subscription to your local newspaper with patriotism. I mean, I know that the media has been called the fourth estate. I can't imagine that any of the other three, portions of the government would in any way be functional without having a critical media. We've seen evidence of the fact that now the judiciary has rejected the scrutiny of the other two branches of the government. And what other alternative is there but to have the media shaming them continuously? And it's going to take years probably to get that judicial institution to begin to actually shine the light on its own.
Gotcha, Barry. Thanks a lot for the call. There's a Thomas Jefferson quote, I think, that I'm
going to
butcher here, but I'd rather have a press without a government than government without a press, something like that.
Yes.
That reminds Barry's thoughts. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Barry is spot on, and thank you for recognizing the role of journalism. Now, that's not to say that journalists always get it right, mm-hmm. that they always serve as the best check on other powerful institutions. Sometimes they're very much in line with other powerful institutions. Mm-hmm. But I think we have example upon example of example here in Wisconsin and across the country where we are served as citizens by the work of journalists who do their job with integrity.
Thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us now in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Yes. So first off, I just wanted to say thank you to NPR for putting a spot on this, as always. Terrific. And second of all, I don't know if my wife and I are kind of the exception to the rule, but we are constantly, regardless of paywall, trying to seek out the most fair and honest reporting to make the best judgment of government or what's going on locally. So unfortunate as it is, in as much as I disagree that it shouldn't be, journalism has to be funded in some form. So if we have to, we're happy to pay for it if need be.
And Chris, may I ask, do you and your wife subscribe to any particular outlets?
We run the gamut. We go around the country. I'd like to go to look at what's going on in L.A., San Diego, New York, Chicago, to try and get a feel of what's going on around the country, and it helps give a balance to what a reporter might be bringing forward.
Chris, thanks for the call. Katie?
You know, I think, Chris, thanks again, Chris, for being a great news consumer. I think you raised an interesting point that makes me remember I should have pointed to two other things. So really in the area of antitrust, that's something where news organizations are held up by law from cooperating and setting subscription prices and that sort of thing and subscription agreements. So, you know, as Chris tries to look at Arizona, L.A., wouldn't it be great if he had one central, you know, news subscriber account where he could go to all of these other outlets? You know, everybody is like, oh, I pay for this Gannett paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but I go to the Gannett paper in Tennessee to try to find out what's going on there, and I can't log in. So I think that's an important element. And then also related to antitrust, news outlets have not been able to band together to deal with big tech when it comes to setting ad rates. And that's a real problem. There was an effort to push that forward, a bipartisan effort in Congress last year. It went down in flames, unfortunately. But that's something that we're going to need to look at, too.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Katie, for years I was hearing like, okay, we're right on the verge of microtransactions for media. So, you know, I'm online a lot for my job. And hey, there's this cool article in the Miami Herald or Philadelphia Inquirer. The model was supposed to be I could put $50 into an account and I'd open this article for $1. That seems to have disappeared. I haven't heard anything about that lately.
Well, a lot of us were hopeful that if Elon Musk were living on planet Earth instead of on Mars, that's what he would have done with Twitter. He would have turned it into a micropayments platform that actually could have helped support publishers for the work that they do put out. I haven't lost all hope, but again, we're not going to see any forward motion on that when we have antitrust restrictions on publishers.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Katie Culver from the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics, looking at how we pay for our news, whether we pay for our news. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi. Say, there's a site on the internet called archive.is. It's pretty easy to get to. It's about a week behind, but almost every article printed in this country and around the world is posted on that. It's a free service. And like I said, it's about a week behind, but it's, you know, if you can't afford it, you can afford this.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen links to this. I'm not sure how it works legally and or ethically, Katie.
Yeah, there's some real intellectual property questions around this. But some news outlets are trying, testing being part of free services to bring people in and then drive them to other content and bring in more eyes on their ads. So just be careful. Anything that's offered for free, always ask what's the quality of that and do they really own it?
Speaking of, thanks again for that call. Speaking of, you mentioned the links between social media and journalism. Obviously, a lot of people on social media share links to journalism. A lot of questions about how the money flows, who ends up profiting from this. The infamous pivot to video from a few years back where Facebook basically single-handedly persuaded newspapers to start doing more videos that I think hardly anybody watched. Your thoughts on social media and how it's affected journalism?
Well, it's affected journalism in a lot of ways, but one of the ways that I like to point to the most is that it's important to think about ethics right now, not just in terms of journalism, but in terms of all public communication. So, you know, journalism is my life, and I will love it forever. But it's one piece of our information ecology. And if the other pieces of that ecology are toxic, then we have problems. You know, I noticed in the news break leading in that we saw that we were hearing a news story about an amazing rise in youth voters. That is not driven by local newspapers. That is driven by TikTok. And so if we have a prayer for the future, it's got to be that all public communicators feel a sense of responsibility to truth and to minimizing harm and the like.
Yeah, that's it. It's a constant dilemma, even for us at public radio. How much do we do on a social media platform? How reliable is that platform as ownership changes, whether that's Elon Musk or a Chinese company owning TikTok? How are you seeing journalism outlets try to navigate that?
I think a lot of journalism outlets recall very well the hard lesson they learned with the, quote, pivot to video, and almost universally lost money on that experiment. So I think there's a little bit more of a conservative approach now, but definitely an emphasis on younger users, readers, viewers, and bringing in that audience. And given that they're more politically engaged than their predecessor generations, maybe they will turn more to news. I can only hope.
In just our last minute, what do you have your eye on now? What is on the horizon that has you excited and or worried or both?
Actually, that youth engagement does have me very optimistic. My glass is very half full with the generation that's coming through my classrooms right now. They're smart. They want to be informed. They want neutral information, and they really care. They want a world that aligns with their values, and that makes me very optimistic. Now, if I can just convince them to read up for something other than answering my news quizzes, that'd be great.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to be here.
Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the role of online paywalls in news coverage and how we can make high-quality reporting financially viable for news outlets and their audiences. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett. Now, when you buy a product, a phone, a computer printer, a car, a coffee maker, a piece of farm equipment, do you own it? Easy question, right? Of course you own it. You bought it. But our next guest says, wait, not so easy. If you crack the screen on the phone, can you repair it yourself or take it to any shop? Some manufacturers might stop certain features on your phone if you do. Same goes for expensive combines and tractors on farms. And more manufacturers are creating subscription fees to use features on your product. Some car companies, for example, have fees to use your seat warmer or enhanced acceleration features, again, on the car you bought. Printers get mad at you if you try to use third-party ink cartridges. Our next guest says we're seeing ownership rights chipped away, but we can do something about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you run into this? Have you tried to repair something or get something repaired, but found out that you could void a warranty or even end up with an unusable product? Have you bought something and then had to pay a regular fee to keep using some features on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nathan Proctor is Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group. Nathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Now, I've heard about the repair issues, and we'll talk about the right to repair concept in a bit. But this new piece you wrote, we've got it linked at WPR.org/Central Time. Something a little different here. How are companies finding ways to get people to keep paying to use features of products they already bought?
Yeah, it's something that is kind of at the heart of the right to repair campaign, is this premise that you bought it, you own it, you should be able to use it however you want. But because the products that we use now are dependent on software and the internet, there's just all kinds of opportunities for the manufacturer to code them in such a way or to control them through the internet in such a way where they get to tell you what to do with the product. And a lot of times they're using that control to get you to buy more things from the company, more services, you know, upgrades. I mean, people know the printer ink, for example, you know, that if you want to get the printer ink that's made by the company, it's a lot more expensive than the alternatives. But the alternatives, it's very difficult to get them to work. And that's because of the software restrictions that are put inside the printer that just make it hard for the you know, aftermarket companies to supply compatible cartridges. And this is happening. It's going to happen more and more, especially with the internet, because that gives companies the ability to you know, change the terms of use remotely to try to continually, you know, hassle you to get you to buy more stuff from them. And that's wrong.
I shared one of the examples from the piece you wrote. I had not heard of this. A couple of car companies are saying, yeah, your car comes with a seat warmer, and if you subscribe and pay money, you can use the seat warmer and some other features. What is going on in cars?
Well, I mean, the companies that make these cars are being basically pushed to find ways to get more monthly revenue out of the car. And it doesn't matter if it's fair or reasonable in some of these examples. It's just technologically possible. It's actually technologically trivial, right? But it's extractive and wrong. Like that same example, I mean, the first time I heard of that, I was like, well, why wouldn't you just bypass the internet and put a switch there? I mean, the seat heater is physically in the car. It's not difficult to turn something on and off. You don't need an internet connection for that feature. It'd be like if the person who made you, a contractor who built your house, charged you monthly subscription fees so that the light switches worked. I mean, we wouldn't accept that because it's ridiculous, and we shouldn't accept it in our cars either.
There's just a few examples in your piece. If I'm reading you right, your concern is this is just the early wave, and we're going to see a lot more of this kind of thing potentially in consumer products.
Yeah, I was talking with you know, a friend of mine at a child's birthday party, and he said that, you know, in his line of work, there's just these Wall Street guys, he said, come in and they just try to push you to find whatever way you can to find some way to force people to pay monthly for things. And there's so much pressure because there's so much profit margin in that kind of business operation that they're just going to, even if it doesn't make any sense, even if it drives customers crazy, there's just so much money to be made that unless we set up rules to say you're not allowed to do this, it's just going to happen more and more with more different products.
Talking to Nathan Proctor with US PERG. He heads the campaign for the right to repair there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about these ways that companies try to get you to pay for stuff monthly that you already bought from them, and the right to repair and how difficult it can be to repair things yourself or to go to a repair shop unless it's the manufacturer's repair shop. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ryan is with us in Green Bay. Ryan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
I just want to say, as somebody who's kind of been the family IT repair guy, who's been working on fixing cracked screens since Samsung Galaxy S1, that I find this whole right to repair thing absolutely critical to fighting the, you know, subscription-based model that we seem to be moving for absolutely everything. If we want to talk about vehicles, let's talk about John Deere and how they're affecting the farming equipment that's being used by farmers in our region. If we want to talk about consumer products, we can talk about Apple and their continued fight to not include USB-C standardization in the EU, even though it's been passed by law. I feel like if somebody like me, who knows how to repair things and has you know, the will to learn how to do so, because I don't have a degree in IT or anything like that, but I can, you know, put a couple screws together and I can remove some glue. I should be able to do that for something that I already paid for, and I shouldn't be stuck behind some kind of firmware wall when it comes to some sort of software keeping me from using my device exactly how I want to. And if anybody wants to look up more of this right to repair stuff in a digestible way, please look up Lewis Rossman on YouTube. I've been following him for years now, and it's just a great resource in terms of trying to figure out what this thing is all about and how important it is to us as consumers in a capitalist society that says we should be able to own things. No, maybe not so much.
Ryan, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Nathan, Ryan, pretty fired up there. Clearly, a couple things he brought up. First of all, he's been replacing screens on his family's phones of various makes and models for years. You write that there was at least for a while an effort to say, yeah, if you start doing that, we're going to start cutting some of your functionality. What did we see there?
Yeah, so in when the iPhone 13 first came out, if you replace the screen, you know, the front-facing camera, which handles the Face ID, is connected to the screen. And if you had it repaired outside of Apple's control, basically without Apple software, it would deactivate Face ID. It would become inoperable. And so eventually Apple pushed out a firmware update that would made it possible for aftermarket, you know, shops to repair the screen. And now it just gives you a warning that, you know, ooh, this was done by somebody who was non-genuine or whatever. And I agree with the caller 100%. And you can just hear how frustrated and annoying it is to be told that you can't do something just because you're not blessed by the manufacturer. I think it's fundamentally un-American. Like, we're a nation of tinkerers and makers. Like, we're not just consumers, like, we're producers. So many of the innovations that make our lives great are things that, you know, people came up with tinkering in their garage, including these companies that are now telling us we're not smart enough to touch our own products. Like, they started in garages. And I think that they need to extend the same kind of collaborative, you know, cooperative hand to us that made their technology possible.
Ryan also brought up a key issue here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Very expensive farm equipment with proprietary software, unique tools that you might only be able to get at a manufacturer-approved shop. What are we seeing there, Nathan?
Well, first of all, I mean, I would say that for both, you know, these consumer products and farm equipment, we've now won state laws which mandate that the companies like Apple and John Deere have to share the materials that they use in their authorized repair shops with independent mechanics and technicians and product owners. But farm equipment is a huge, you know, leading issue on right to repair, in part because farmers are completely dependent on functional working equipment to make a living and to stay in business and to keep their farm. And when the only way to get something fixed because of an intentional technological lock on the equipment that makes it so you have to use certain software tools to get it working again, and the dealer is the only one in possession of those tools, like, that creates a huge problem for farmers. The biggest problem there is the downtime. If the equipment's not working and you need to get the, you know, the seed in the ground or get the fertilizer down or harvest the crop before a big storm, you're not going to want to be told by the equipment dealer, oh, we can't come out today, or we can't come out till 3 weeks from now. One example from Oklahoma in a recent report that we put out Out to Pasture said that the dealer told me it was going to be 9 months before they could calibrate the hydraulic equipment on his equipment so that it would go back into service. 9 months, that's an entire season. That's ridiculous.
Thanks again for that call, Ryan. We're talking to Nathan Proctor from US PERG about a recent piece he wrote on the death of ownership and the ways companies get us to keep paying for things we already bought and make it hard to get our stuff repaired unless we go to the company that made it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like it's gotten more difficult to repair stuff? Electronics, appliances, tractors, you name it. Do you have a product where you have to use something proprietary made by that company, printer cartridges, coffee refills, you name it, just to use the product you bought? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at USPIRG, the Public Interest Research Group, looking at the way companies make it harder for us to get consumer products repaired and new technologies that make us keep paying to use features on things we already bought, from phones and farm equipment, coffee makers to cars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nathan, before I go back to our callers, you mentioned some states are passing laws, including just very recently, our neighbors in Minnesota. What did we see there?
Yeah, Minnesota passed the broadest right to repair law we've seen. It mandates that manufacturers of a lot of products, although unfortunately not including farm equipment, have to share all the parts, tools, and information that they make available for their own authorized networks to fix things to the product owner and to independent shops. So starting in July of next year, it's going to be a lot easier to fix products in Minnesota, everything from, you know, dishwashers and cell phones to, you know, enterprise computing equipment and HVAC and a whole set of other products. And I think it's going to save people a lot of money. And it's going to cut electronic waste. And it's a really, really big deal.
Let's go back to our callers now. Rob is with us in Markesan. Rob, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Rob?
Microsoft. Recently, they did a deal where they did an update. And basically, all of the Office application on my computer disappeared. And finally got a hold of them on it. And took 3 weeks before they finally gave me a copy of it back, which was a different copy than what I had. So my product key didn't work. I had to spend another week to get the right flavor. But yeah, they did it as part of an update and it just disappeared. And it took almost a month to prove that I paid for it and that they should give it back.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. Nathan, whether it's a computer or anything else that uses software, that software update, that's a chance for companies to do stuff that consumers like Rob aren't going to be too happy about.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly, I mean, one of the things that happens pretty frequently is a loss of features with an update. And that can be really upsetting. Like, you know, and you wonder if some of these updates are really to improve the security or the device operation or to accomplish something else. And I think, I mean, from a cybersecurity perspective, it's really scary when companies put, you know, kind of other anti-consumer updates in those update files, because we really want people to update everything to the most latest version to patch vulnerabilities that help protect the internet against cybercrime. But people are resistant to doing that because they've had these experiences where they've lost key functionality because an update had some other change in it. And I think that that's definitely something that companies need to pay a little bit more attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. Bridget joins us now in Superior. Bridget, hi.
Hi. I had a situation with a air conditioner, and I called the thermal guy who put it in, and he came out and took some parts apart and left it undone. I asked him to come and put it back together. He didn't, and I kept calling about the part. Got to the point where he wouldn't return my calls. Went on, I called different companies, and by the time the next company came, left it exposed, mice had chewed it. So, yeah, so then it wasn't, then they wouldn't cover the warranty, and he wouldn't return my calls.
Bridget, thanks for the call. Nathan, I don't know if this is exactly a right to repair issue, but the idea that if there's only one game in town, only the manufacturer can repair it. If that was the case in Bridget's, I don't think that probably was here, you'd have no recourse. The idea that, okay, there might be multiple places you can go to get something repaired gives us a better chance that we're going to find somebody who can do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say, your likelihood of getting a good experience with a service technician is really enhanced by competition, kind of weeding the market of people who treat customers like this story we just heard. Like, hopefully we can the market will squeeze those people out, and so that companies that treat their customers well and charge them a fair rate are the only ones around.
Bridget, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nathan Proctor, Senior Director for the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Racine. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I wanted to comment or at least ask for some commentary on the transition to software as a service or computing as a service overall, in that we're actually losing access to our computing devices and the software on them in a push for greater revenue and, more pervasive and perpetual licensing of software. You used to be able to buy Microsoft Office one time and use it for a decade, and now Microsoft wants us to buy a perpetual license every year. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that as it relates to the topic.
Interesting, Aaron. Thanks for that. Interesting question. Nathan, what do you think? We used to buy a box of software, install it ourselves, and own it as long as we had that computer. Now it's a service, Aaron says.
Yeah, I mean, this is the blessing and the curse of the internet, right? Where software is not a static application anymore, right? Because, a Nintendo cartridge pretty much plays the same now as it did, back in 1986. But the other games that we're playing are all dependent on the internet. And that just completely changes what we're buying when we buy software. I think that this is a big question. And I think that there, as I argue in the piece that you're referencing, The Death of Ownership, at least there's truth in advertisement when Microsoft says what you're paying for is the continual monitoring and updating of this, and you pay monthly. At least you know what you're getting. It's obviously different if they sell you something and you think you bought it outright, but really you just bought the first entry and now you have to pay monthly to actually use it. So they're separate issues, but I look forward to a world where there's just a lot more transparency, clarity, and options for people to have more control over the technology in our lives. And one of the problems we have in an overly consolidated tech market is, if people would rather just pay once and have something static and lasted exactly the way they bought it, maybe they would. But with so few options in the tech market, there's just not an incentive to create those products because everybody's looking for, these monthly revenue streams. And so they're just going to push us into these systems, whether or not we actually want them.
Thanks for that call, Aaron. And Nathan, talking about transparency, somebody might think, okay, well, I won't buy a product that's going to have this hidden monthly charge to use all of its functions. Is it always that easy to tell when we're buying something that that's going to happen?
I mean, the reason why we have this thing in the Uniform Commercial Code and state laws that protects consumers from unfair and deceptive practices is because you shouldn't have to walk around the Best Buy and think, which of these products is not being marketed to me deceptively to trick me into paying for some monthly thing that I don't know about. Like, we just should not have, you shouldn't walk around the grocery store. Yeah, maybe some of these products that say they're potato chips are really like rat poison. You shouldn't have to worry about that. There should be just standard consumer protection that the products that are being sold are safe and usable. And I think that that's what I'm advocating for, right? If you're going to tether somebody to a secret software arrangement where you get to extract a monthly payment from them, that needs to be exposed and there needs to be transparency there. And people are being, kind of duped by these companies and they find themselves totally dependent on their system, which now all of a sudden is way more expensive than they thought at the outset. And I think that, we should, the system should protect consumers from that kind of deceptive product.
Nathan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
That's Nathan Proctor with the Campaign for the Right to Repair at US PERG. The piece we've been talking about called The Death of Ownership, we've got it linked over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, disabilities and aging don't have to kick us out of the kitchen. It's Food Friday. We'll get advice on cooking for everybody with the author of the new book, Crip Up the Kitchen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.